Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Dr. Avner Cohen, an internationally recognized author and expert on non-proliferation issues focusing on the Middle East. Dr. Cohen is widely known for his path-breaking history of the Israeli nuclear program and is a consultant to a range of NGOs, non-government organizations, and governmental agencies. In early 2010, Dr. Cohen joined the James Martin Center for Non-Proliferation Studies in Washington, D.C. as a senior fellow. Dr. Cohen is a two-time winner of the prestigious MacArthur Foundation Research Writing Awards in 1990 and 2004, and his most acclaimed book, Israel and the Bomb, was published in 1998 in English and in 2000 in Hebrew. His latest book, The Worst-Kept Secret, Israel's Bargain with the Bomb, has just been published in October 2010 by Columbia University Press. Dr. Avner Cohen, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Yes. Well, I must say that as I read your book in the last 2 days, The Worst-Kept Secret, Israel's Bargain with the Bomb, it changed my attitude somewhat towards Israel. As you know, I've always been potently anti-nuclear and absolutely still am, and was potently opposed to Israel's nuclear program and still am. But I guess I understood more deeply for the first time why Israel got the bomb, yet I still don't approve. Why don't we start talking about... Oh, it's hard to know where to start. The first subject you've got is the uniqueness of the Israeli nuclear case. And along with that goes nuclear opacity. In other words, they will neither confirm nor deny they have nuclear weapons. They have not signed the non-proliferation treaty. It all started, Avner Cohen, didn't it, about 15 years after the Holocaust, which... Israelis call a Shoah. Tell us how the idea of nuclear weapons had its origin in Israel.
Well, it started even before that. The notion that Israel should compensate itself for what it lacks in geography, in resources, in material, was in the mind of its founding father, David Ben-Gurion, virtually just a few years after the end of World War II. Already by 1948, as Israel was waging the life of its, the fight for its very existence when it was born, Ben-Gurion felt that the Arab-Israeli conflict was deep and could be lasting, and Israel would not be able to survive by having a war every, a decade or so. So the notion that Israel should prepare itself with what Ben-Gurion considers stable deterrence and perhaps ultimately a way to convince and persuade the Arabs to accept Israel politically was in his mind very, very early on. By 1949, he, on his own instructions, he sent out Israeli scientists to all over the world to start studying nuclear physics. A few years later, he set up the Israeli Atomic Energy Commission. And when he came back to power in 1955, after a quick, short retirement, this was the beginning of search, serious search, how Israel could set up a real nuclear program. The man, the younger man, who was the chief executive officer, is today the president of Israel, Shimon Peres. So this was a project that captured the mind and the imagination of some Israeli in its first decade. And indeed, it was born into reality by 1957, when Israel made its first deal with France to build this major infrastructure near the town of Dimona. Dimona was only excavated at the time as a town from nothing, from the desert. And so it was born in the late 50s. And by 1967, just on the eve of the 67 war, Israel already had something, a device, improvised literally nights before the beginning of the war, and it put Israel in the position that it could demonstrate capability. Yeah. So it took less than 20 years for Israel to develop the capability. By the end of its first decade, it started to move seriously, and within a decade or so, less than a decade, Israel was able to acquire its first device.
Well, let's not call it a device. Let's call it a nuclear weapon. I presume it was...
Well, technically, it was not yet a weapon.
Why?
It was not something that could be delivered yet from airplane. It was certainly not was something that you could put it on a missile. It was very much like what the United States had in 1945 in July on that tower in New Mexico.
Trinity, that, the first bomb.
So we call it a device.
Oh, yeah, I know, but that... Okay, you're being interviewed by me now, Avner, and I'm not going to go for euphemisms. It was a nuclear weapon, and I guess it was an atomic bomb, like Trinity with an explosive power, was it? About 13 to 20 kilotons?
Yeah.
A kiloton is 1,000 tons of TNT, so reasonably big. Okay, so it had its first nuclear bomb in 1957. Now, the interesting thing is, how the hell did it obtain the nuclear knowledge? Well, of course, many people in the Manhattan Project who made the first bombs were Jewish, Oppenheimer, Teller, and many, many of the others. And, of course, this knowledge was not... it was widely known amongst scientists and Jewish scientists. So, but it could not have happened without the help of the French government. So why did France assist Israel in building Dimona, the nuclear reactor, and the reprocessing plant? Why did they?
Well, it's a number of reasons. It's not just one. The immediate one was some alliance of interest between the leaders of France during its Fourth Republic. They were stuck by the rebellion in Algeria. Israel was the enemy of the ally of the rebels in Algeria, especially Jamal Abdel Nasser. The Israeli provided some intelligence. So there was this confluence of interest on this issue. But it was deeper than just that. I think there was a sense of guilt and a sense of sympathy over what happened to the Jews during World War II.
Mm.
I think there was an interest in France to go themselves all the way to have nuclear weapons. As you recall, in 1957, France itself was still hesitating for a very, very long time before it made its own decision. And, of course, there was an interest to boost the French industry, nuclear industry, defense industry, and Israel provided a great deal of cash for that. Israel was the first major client for that industry. So it was a number of interests that all of them together made France to be the major supplier to Israel, but not the only one. Norway, and to some lesser extent, Canada and the United States also provided some help.
So Israel helped to finance France's nuclear program.
No, I didn't say that. But what I was trying to say is that Israelis were trying to plant in the mind of French scientists that they may have some access to American knowledge that the French cannot get them directly from France, and therefore Israel can be helpful to get some expertise and some knowledge that Israel may have a unique access. In some indirect way, yes, Israel was the first major client for the French nuclear industry, and as such, it has helped to fund the French nuclear project in a very limited fashion.
Right.
It was more, it provided some help to those companies who started the French industry in that field.
Now, I want to go back a bit. Britain granted the Jews access to the land that they now occupy in Israel. What year was that Britain granted access for Israel?
Well, the occupation starts in 1967. Are you referring to the occupation following the 67 war?
No, I'm not. I'm talking about when the Jews first moved into Palestine.
This was a late 19th century. This is called the first wave of immigration in the 80s of the 19th century.
Okay, but let's move to the 20th century after the Holocaust. When did that happen?
Well, as you know, Israel was a tiny Jewish enclave.
Yeah.
Immediately after the Holocaust, it was about 600,000 Jews who were living in Palestine around 47, 48.
Yeah.
In a very unprecedented effort to bring Jews from all over the world, first refugees from Europe, often via Cyprus, and then others from the Middle East, Yemen and Iraq. Within a decade, by 1958, 10 years after Israel had been established, the population was close to 2 million.
2 million.
2 million.
Yeah, okay, so...
And Israel today is about 7.5 million people. 80% or a little less than 80% are Jews, and slightly more than 20% are non-Jews, mostly Arabs.
Yes. So, Avner Cohen, I didn't go through the Holocaust, although when I was 2 in 1940, my mother in Melbourne, Australia, told me that Hitler was killing the Jews, and I used to look out the kitchen window and see a bit of bare land in the distance, and I thought that was probably Germany where this was happening. So I grew up knowing it, but never, of course, having experienced it. So it's clear from reading your book, and I guess I knew this all along, but it became even more apparent that the wound created by the Holocaust in the Jewish psyche is so profound that they say never again, and in order to make sure never again, they decided, in their wisdom or not, to develop nuclear weapons. Would that be an accurate summary in a very simplistic way, Avner?
I think so. I think it's fair. I think one way to put it is that in order, and again, I would like to put the two major landmarks of World War II in the most visible sense, and they're both very critical both for Jewish history and for human history. The connection between Auschwitz on the one hand and Hiroshima and Nagasaki on the other hand. One could say that in order to prevent another Auschwitz, Israel felt that it must be in a position to inflict, nothing that did not say to do it, but to inflict another Hiroshima or another Nagasaki. So there is, of course, a very strong connection between the Shoah, which is the Hebrew word for Holocaust, and the nuclear pursuit. It's a very deep one, it's a very traumatic one, and it's very alive one, because even when you talk today about Iran, as you know, right or wrong, with political connotation or without political connotations. Very often when the Israelis talk about Ahmadinejad today of Iran, they think about Hitler. I personally think it's unfortunate. It's not a good analogy, but it just highlights the role and the place of the Holocaust, of the Shoah, in this issue.
Yeah, but it seems to me, as a semi-objective observer, I suppose, that to be prepared to create another Holocaust upon other people is ultimately crazy. You know, having been through it themselves and knowing how hideous it was, to be prepared to do that to another group of people, it sort of takes my breath away.
Helen, you touch in a very profound point. And I think that point that you just touched is at least as deep as the political reasons why Israel invented a very strange, a very schizophrenic attitude towards nuclear weapons. I think the whole idea of opacity, or amimut in Hebrew...
Explain to the audience what opacity is, Avner Cohen.
Well, I'm trying to say that the very idea of a unique, strange, paradoxical, schizophrenic posture, a way of handling nuclear weapons, a very special bargain with the bomb, is because Israel could not openly see itself as having weapons that can cause, or ultimately threatening to cause, another Holocaust to somebody else. I think part of the inhibitions for Jews and Israelis to acknowledge having the bomb and their reliance on the bombs are much deeper than just issues of politics between Israel and the United States and the non-proliferation regime. And it has to do with what you just had said before, that is to say, the impact of the power of the Holocaust and the difficulty to see themselves as having the weapons that can bring Holocaust to somebody else.
Yeah, but I guess that still doesn't satisfy me. I've often thought of anyone in the world who would understand suffering and the reasons for it and who could rise above it, as many Israeli and Jewish writers have, are the Jews who've been through this extraordinarily dreadful experience and would learn about it and rise above it. I can understand the threat to their survival and existence by being surrounded by semi-hostile countries. On the other hand, it, as you just said, Avner Cohen, the philosophy and issue goes beyond that. I mean, it's so profound. And if we are to, in fact, survive as a human species, because I've thought about this long and hard, we at some point have to lift ourselves up from our moral turpitude and sort of primitive instincts and realize that we have to stop killing each other in order to survive in the nuclear age, because the ultimate issue, and I'm sure you've thought of this deeply too, Avner Cohen, is that we have now the capacity to destroy ourselves as a species and many other species. And indeed, as we speak, South Korea is sending, bullets and shells and weapons into North Korea, and there lies the seeds or the spark for a global nuclear holocaust. I mean, it's becoming more and more likely as we proceed each day.
Well, Helen, as you know, I'm not exactly the advocate of nuclear weapons, but I'm trying to understand from the point of view of a historian, from the point of view even of a philosopher, why at a particular point and a nation in very early age like Israel felt the need to do it, and why they did it in a very unique way, a way that is very, very different from all other countries that went nuclear. So I think there are layers of reasons why they came out and why they came up with this notion of non-acknowledgement, what we call opacity. I think one of them is the difficulties to acknowledge and the deep inhibitions involved with generating such awesome weapons. Another one was also a domestic political issue. I think some people in Israel from the very beginning were deeply concerned that even from the self-interest of Israel itself, if Israel itself legitimized the road to nuclear weapons in the Middle East, sooner or later, the other side, that is, the Arabs, will or would acquire those weapons themselves. And that from Israeli perspective, from self-interest of Israel itself, that would be very, very bad, because it would flip the whole calculation. From security, you move to insecurity. So I think from even political domestic perspective, this policy of opacity was a sort of compromise between the two camps, that whatever Israel does, she doesn't say it openly. She doesn't say it openly to itself. She doesn't say it openly to others. And, of course, there was the special understanding with the United States. So on a number of layers, on the layers of psychology and culture, the layers of domestic politics, the layers of international politics, and in particular the relations between Israel and the United States, there were strong forces, I think much forces than any individual, any specific individual, that led Israel during those formative years, the 1960s, 50s and 60s, to do what they did in a very different way than other people did it.
But they didn't really do it in a different, to put it quite frankly, and I guess I always think as a physician, they didn't do it in any other way. They built a reactor at Dimona. They made plutonium by fissioning uranium. They then, underneath the reactor, had a huge dugout area. What's it called? I can't remember the name they call it. A huge dugout area where they had a reprocessing plant.
Down in the basement.
That's
floor below. Yeah.
Yeah, and they obtained plutonium, and they made bombs. The fact that
now, the physics is the same physics.
Yeah, the reality is the same.
Different.
I know the culture, but that's not the point, Avner. They have made bombs, and the truth is, although they will neither confirm nor deny, and they hide underneath this sort of rhetoric of, well, you know, really we don't have it, but really don't tell anyone we do, but we really don't, sort of stuff. Kids, nobody. I mean, everybody in the Middle East knows about it. In fact, everyone in the world knows about it. And there are estimates to say that Israel now has the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world after America and Russia, that, you know, the high estimate is 400 nuclear weapons and the low is, you know, less than 100. But, of course, we don't really know. So although there's this sort of subterfuge going on, as my father always used to say, don't kid yourself, Helen. I think he always used to say that to me. So I think they're sort of kidding themselves behind this lie.
No, I think it's deeper than that. And part of my interest was to understand that depth.
Yeah.
Not that I'm advocating this depth, and I'm actually advocating to go beyond that. And time has come to come clean and to deal with the truth. But even in terms of understanding the past, yes, the physics is the same physics. It's the physics of nuclear weapons. There is no question. There is only one physics. You make nuclear weapons either out of plutonium or out of highly enriched uranium, and that's it. So there is no difference between, in principle, between American, Chinese, Israeli, or North Korean or Indian. One country make a better design or less better design, but the physical outcome is essentially one and the same. However,
a Holocaust.
No, however, in terms of attitude towards it, in terms of caution towards it, I think Israel was, and even in terms of the organization under which Israel set up its program, Israel was in many ways unique. For example, I believe that from early on, and this is a legacy that came all the way to today, Israel Israeli weapons are not under the Israeli army.
Uh-huh.
It's under a different organization, under the prime minister, and essentially accepts unique moment of alert, like war. They're never under the control of the military in the strict sense of the word. So that's one thing. There are also rumors that Israeli weapons are never fully assembled. They are...
Of course.
That's right. They are unassembled. And you put them together again only in a moment of alert. Israel had a strong temptation to demonstrate its capability in the 67 and 73 war. And yet the people in charge, the prime minister, at either time, refused to do so. So there are elements and layers of caution and attitude of, you can call it respect or understanding, some of the elements of the nuclear age. The physics is the same physics, no question about that. But in terms of attitude, I think Israel has made its own, what I call in the book, bargain, which is different.
Yeah, well, kind of. I mean, for a pragmatist like me, it's no different. The other thing I'm wondering about Avner Cohen, I'm interviewing, by the way, Dr. Avner Cohen, an internationally recognized author and expert on non-proliferation issues, particularly in Israel and the Middle East. From my reading, which is quite extensive in the past, I thought Israel participated in testing a nuclear weapon in South Africa. Did it or did it not?
Well, there are strong suspicions, rumors. The issue has never been fully clarified and established. Of course, Israel has never taken responsibility, and no country, including the United States, who looked into that incident, what is known as the double flash, in the hours of the dawn in September 1979, the United States has never made allegation that accused Israel as having a test. So many people believe it was a test. Many people believe that there was something there, but we are not exactly sure what it was. That incident remained to some extent mysterious.
Yeah, it sounds, again, like a cover-up, like the way Golda Meir and Richard Nixon did a deal together in 1969 and nothing's been... What amazes me is there is no record of this meeting, no written record. Nixon never talked about it. Golda Meir never talked about it, but apparently they agreed together on a walk through the grounds in the White House that both would go along with the attitude and with the misnomer with the it's really a lie that Israel didn't have nuclear weapons because Israel would neither confirm nor deny nuclear weapons. I mean, it's clear that America, because of America's attitude that it would go along with Israel in all of this nuclear development, so Israel has been able to get away with it. And I'm not blaming Israel, but I'm talking about history, which you clearly enunciate in your book, The Worst-Kept Secret, Israel's Bargain with the Bomb.
Well, the United States, I think in particular Nixon and Henry Kissinger, his aide, they faced a moment of they had to take a decision. And they had to make a policy towards Israel when it became quite apparent that Israel has reached the nuclear threshold. And the issue will, and I'm telling in the book quite details what happened, the bureaucracy and the leaders, the president. And I think ultimately they decided to take, and I think Nixon was sympathetic from the very beginning because to some extent it relieved him from the need to provide Israel a security guarantee. And I think he felt okay about Israel's responsibility in this area. And essentially, they made Israel an exception. They don't deny it. They decided just to look the other way. They decided just to keep as if they're ignorant about it and to be satisfied with the formula that Israel was actually using even before that deal. And the formula is still being used to this very day, which says that Israel will not be the first to introduce nuclear weapons to the region.
Yeah, which is crazy because they have. And that, you see, it leads...
And one way to understand that formula is it's a pledge not to move anything from the public or the invisible area to from the private or the invisible area to the public and the visible area.
Yeah, but
in other words, it's a commitment to secrecy. It's a commitment to non-acknowledgement. It's a commitment to concealment. It's a commitment to keep it a secret.
Yeah, well, as we would have said as medical students, that's rhubarb. I mean, facts are facts, and everyone knows that Israel has a large nuclear arsenal. I mean, it's absolutely well known throughout the world, not the least because you've had some whistleblowers like Mordecai Vanunu, which we'll get into in a moment. But the other thing that's always amazed me, Avner, is you would have thought that Israel would realize that if it built nuclear weapons, all countries around it are going to say, well, hell, if they've got nuclear weapons, why shouldn't we? It's sort of an example sticking out like a sore tooth that, the countries can't say we're the only ones that have got nuclear weapons. That's how the arms race started in the first place. America had them and they said no way would Russia ever get the secret. And within 5 years, Russia had its own bombs. And so, you know, as we know, entering the portal of the nuclear club, having only one bomb, like maybe North Korea did, means that you are relatively invulnerable. And therefore, the Iranians, who are very, very proud people, Persians, they're not Arabs, Persians, although they've got a madman now at the moment, Ahmadinejad, they look at Israel and say, well, hell, you know, if they've got weapons, why shouldn't we? And you can see that, although there is no really good objective evidence at the moment that Iran has nuclear weapons, nor that it really wants to develop them, according to the IAEA, but, you know, they could be doing that. But you can understand their attitude, and also countries around them, like Syria and like the Arab Emirates and like Saudi Arabia, all of whom want nuclear reactors now, ostensibly to develop nuclear power and electricity. But the truth is that any country that has a reactor for electricity can make bombs. So Israel is at a point now surrounded by countries who within a very short space of time will be able to, and in fact probably will, make their own nuclear weapons.
Well, that's a dilemma, and that's a challenge, and that's a tough situation. There is no question that the Israelis, the reason why they decided to take that gamble and to do what they did was that it's worth it as long as you have the monopoly.
Yep.
And I think the issue that Israel is trying to have its, the whole nuclear situation in the Middle East, from Israeli perspective, is an effort to keep this monopoly at least for the time being, at least for the time that you have the conflict, the Arab-Israeli conflict. So far, Israel, surprisingly to some extent, successful in keeping that monopoly alive. I mean, Israel today is the only country in the Middle East. One reason why Israel was able to do it successfully was because Israel took this the least benign, the least aggressive posture, the posture of opacity. I agree with you, Helen, that for the long run, that may not be working. And I agree with you that ultimately Israel would have to be a part of the equation in the Middle East. So this is not viable for the long term. However, for the short term, Israel surprisingly was able to impose and to prevail with its own monopoly. And the great fear, and that's a great deal of the reality under which you see the rivalry between Israel and Iran, is the future of that monopoly.
Of course, but...
It's not so much that Iran is an existential threat to Israel, but Iran is a threat to Israel monopoly.
Well, you say in the short run it's still okay, but I tell you what, it's the short run that it won't be, because the way the nuclear industry is moving now throughout the world, helter-skelter with the help of Russia and France and God knows whom, and America, every country will have a reactor, and then every country will be able to make its own bomb. And don't forget, Avna, that plutonium lasts for, you know, 250,000 years. So even though right now, for the next 5 years or less, Israel may be able to maintain its monopoly forevermore, as dictatorships come and go, as empires come and go, the plutonium will be available in huge quantities to make nuclear weapons. And if you look at it clearly, from a clinical perspective, a prognostic perspective, are we going to survive? I mean, the whole thing leads to absolute nuclear insanity. In fact, whatever rationale, whatever opacity, whatever way we try and kid ourselves, we mustn't kid ourselves, and we're on the path to nuclear annihilation. I can't see any other way to put it.
Well, I'm not in disagreement with you as far as the long term is involved, and that's the reason why the book is calling for Israel to have a new bargain, which ultimately I would like to see Israel as part of the vision of a world without nuclear weapons. I would like Israel to be part of the vision of delegitimizing the bomb.
Uh-huh.
I don't believe that the bomb ultimately is a source of security.
Uh-huh.
So in that respect, the long run, I agree with you, and I would like Israel to go in that direction.
Well, how do
I going to see it anytime soon? No, I don't. I'm realistic enough to know that's not going to happen. But part of this effort is first to understand the predicament. And I think in this book I was trying to unmask or to remove this guise of opacity, which I refer as the worst-kept secret, to create conditions for a dialogue, for a conversation on reality as it is. And even though I may be a little bit more sympathetic than you about the past to Israel, I think that for the long-run future, that's not the way to do business. And time has come to revisit and to think afresh on the whole thing.
Well, Avner, I think you've done a really good job in explaining what you've just said, why and how Israel got the bomb. And it's made me a little bit more tolerant, I guess, of the situation, but still on the whole intolerant. How do you now suggest, what would be your plan? Say you were the Prime Minister of Israel. What would be your plan to legitimize where, or not legitimize, to come out and say, yes, Israel has the bomb, and these are our plans to move towards nuclear disarmament? You know, and it needs to happen not long term, actually. It needs to happen quite short term, particularly as we have a president in the White House who goes along with the notion and concept of nuclear abolition, and that's the first time that's ever happened in the history of the nuclear age.
Well, as you know, the president in the White House, even though his instincts are good ones, in terms of action, he has not done that much, unfortunately, to promote that vision. I mean, beautiful words and beautiful music, but in terms of action, very little was made. Look, I think that... I don't have much hope, unfortunately, from the present government in Israel.
Mm.
Not on the nuclear issue and not on the real issue that underlying the nuclear issue, which is the question of, you know, war and peace with the Arabs, in particular with the Palestinians. I would like, you know, I think that Israel should seek, you know, one of the sad things that I see is Israel, which the one that I grew up in, was essentially seeking and interested in peace. Current Israel is much less interested in peace, and that's unfortunate. I think that there could be, I don't think that there is anything in the heaven that prevents peace between Israelis and Palestinians. I think the much of the parameters of such peace are known to everybody. Essentially, Israel has to withdraw from almost all the territories. Some small territories could be swept, and both sides has to look future-oriented rather than to deal with the past. And I think that under that kind of deal, there could be a situation of two states. It may be not as simple as I'm trying to describe in a few sentences, but the scheme is basically simple and is known by the parties. Unfortunately, do I see it coming in the coming months? No, I don't. And it's sad. I think once you have that issue, once you have a real progress towards peace, the Iranian issue, the Iranian threat, looked at a very different perspective. I think that, for example, one way to think about the disclosing of the Israeli bomb is, again, in a good political moment. A good political moment would be after some progress on the Palestinian side, and perhaps Israel and the Arabs would be willing to move, say, according to the so-called Saudi plan, which become the Arab League's plan, again, based on reconciliation, which will take time. It's not going to be overnight, but reconciliations between Palestinians and Israelis. I think that even for the time being, to do that, Israel would have to be strong, and Israel would have to keep some elements of deterrence. But I think the beginning of integrating into the directions of delegitimizing nuclear weapons and towards a process that would lead to the Middle East to be a nuclear-free zone could be once you start to reach peace first with the Palestinians and then, of course, with the rest of the Arabs.
And then, yeah, well, that's fair enough. Well, how can we work to get you to be Prime Minister, Avner?
Well, I don't know. That may be a little different Israel than you and I see today, and at least in the Israel that I'm not happy to see. But I think that it's not impossible.
No, and there's a very large population in Israel, Peace Now and others, who really, really would like to settle the issue of the occupied territories and the two-state solution. They're ready for it. But the problem is there's a very deep division, isn't there, Avner Cohen, within Israeli society about what to do about this?
That's one aspect. Israeli society today is highly fragmented. It's been a number of strongly divided segments of society. That's one thing. Also, I believe that there is a majority of the Israelis small majority, not a major majority, but a small majority who knows the parameter of peace and are ready to make a compromise towards that kind of peace. One of the trouble is that this is a very quiet majority. This majority doesn't go into strikes. This majority doesn't go into demonstrations. And it's a majority that sometimes can be politically manipulated, especially, with the words of security and peace and all that. So Israel needs to have a transformation itself in order to start moving into that direction.
Is this majority that supports peace and two-state solution, are they intimidated by the others? And I suppose the sort of shadow of the Holocaust looms in the background, but we really do need them to take up their cudgels, metaphorically, so to speak, and get out in the streets and turn the debate around, even though they've got, people like Netanyahu and Lieberman to contend with. We need these people to become more powerful, don't we?
Yeah. One of the pitfalls of prosperous economy is that people could be numbing because their economic situation is fine, and they live in this insulated bubble of escapism, and after years of striving towards peace, many people lost their own sensitivity, and it's very unfortunate. that the issue of peace is no longer today a very strong social force within Israeli society. That's I witness, and I witness with a lot of pain, with a lot of sorrow, but I think it's fair to describe.
So, Avner Cohen, have you ever been into Palestine and seen the conditions there and seen the wall they've built and, you know, and the obstructions to trade and to food and to medicine and the like? Have you been there and witnessed it?
I have witnessed a small part of that. There is one site in Jerusalem, Sheikh Jarrah, where many people within the Israeli left, the far left, not necessarily the far left, come almost every weekend for demonstrations, and that's almost like a place for an Israeli catharsis. If you don't do the actual thing and if you don't change the regime, at least you have some form of social catharsis. So both areas are the places where Israel is kind of trying to reckon and to come to terms with their own society.
Well, what do you think? What would be the percentage of Israelis who've actually crossed the wall, seen the effect of the sanctions and the way the Palestinians live? What percentage of Israelis have actually informed themselves?
How many people are actually concerned about it?
No, who've actually been into Palestine and seen the conditions there and understand what Israel's doing in Palestine. How many Israelis have actually witnessed that?
You know, it's very strange that even though the distance between Tel Aviv and the West Bank is less than 30 minutes, most Israelis have insulated their life, their existence, their conscience. They just don't want to see it, and they live in a certain denial. And because, you see, it's not just physical wall. It's also psychological and cultural and, of course, political barrier that allows many Israelis just to ignore and to deny the real reality. And that's, you know, there is this paradox that when you become effective in preventing terrorism and you make this wall, you create a situation where the population become numb to the real issue. And they think as if the issue doesn't exist, or the issue is under control, or the issue doesn't have any time urgency. And I think that's one deep reason why the Israeli society lost its sensitivity to the injustice and to the situation that takes place under the occupation.
You know, I hate to say this, Avner, but you know, there were many, many hundreds of thousands of Germans who also turned their back and on the cattle trains and on, you know, Auschwitz and stuff and practiced denial. It's sort of, what can you say? It's pretty awful. And
you know, the huge difference is, of course, that there is no mass killing.
No, that's I agree. But the other thing is that the Palestinians are being abused, and there is cruelty, and we know that, and that's been totally documented, and there's a lot of killing and the like. There is killing, with the most sophisticated weapons the world's ever seen. In truth. And I've thought a lot about this, and I do know from my pediatric background that people who are abused in childhood tend to abuse as they become adults, tend to abuse others. And it's deep in the psyche. It's sort of a vengeance motive that, in a way, the psyche needs. Do you think, Avner, that psychological dynamic is applying to some people in Israel?
Yeah, I do. I do. And there is also the psychological dynamics of, you know, victim becomes to aggressors and become dominating from. So there is all sorts of dynamics that take place. But what I see and what it's really, it tore my heart in terms of witnessing, is the fact that so many good Israelis become numb and become very insulated and isolating themselves from... You see, when you are successful and effective in doing that, and when you don't feel the horror of terror, the result is that there is a make-believe reality as if it's not there, even though it's there. What's there? I mean the injustice, I mean the occupation, the all the things under the under the grounds that leads ultimately to violence and to terrorism. So it's very sad that many Israelis have kept their own existence, their own living, in such a way that they are hardly see any of that.
Einstein said, "The world is a dangerous place to live, not because of the people who are evil, but because of the people who don't do anything about it." And Dante said something of the same kind as well, that the hot places are reserved in hell for people who maintain their neutrality when evil is happening. And I think this applies. We're really talking about deep psychological, not motives, but ways that people use to survive in their everyday lives. And sometimes people in a society can be jerked out of that sense of denial, psychic numbing, as we did in the 80s when we mobilized millions to oppose nuclear war. What I'd end with, and we're nearly running out of time, Avna, is I remember when Rabin was shot by a fellow Israeli, I said to my friend that this is the end for Israel, because Rabin had the incredible integrity and experience as a military man, but wisdom, I think, that could have led Israel out of this dilemma. And unless we get another leader such as Rabin, it all looks pretty hopeless. Would you agree with that, Avner Cohen?
I do. I think that Israel suffers from a crisis of leadership.
Yeah.
At the present time, I do not see leadership, authentic leadership, that can emerge. Maybe there is one. There is a little talk in recent weeks about an interesting general himself who became a dovish leader. Amram Mitzna, his name. It's ironic that when he was the commander of the Central Command, which governs the West Bank under his command, he had to deal with the first Intifada. He was for a short time the leader of the Labor Party, and he failed and he left politics, and he became a volunteered mayor of a small town in the south, and apparently he made miracles.
Huh.
He finished his job just a few weeks ago, and he's considering going back to politics. And a lot of people talk to him as a possible hope in Israeli politics. He just a few days ago, he had a meeting with Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, on the Palestinian side.
Yeah, I saw that. Yep.
Yeah. I hope, and maybe something can come out of it, but structurally, I still don't see. I think there is a deep issue of leadership in Israel. In my personal view, the leadership of Prime Minister Netanyahu is the worst that Israel ever had.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the worst and Prime Minister Israel ever had in a variety of ways. And I hope the internal politics would remove him in the coming year, 2011, out of power. But except Amram Mitzna, the person I was referring to a minute ago, I do not see others. Tzipi Livni, who is now the centrist leader, the leader of the central party called Kadima, she has not convinced me as having the leadership ability to make deep changes in Israeli politics and in Israeli society. So there is no many hopes, but sometimes in a situation of no hope, suddenly something unexpected comes.
Yes, a miracle occurs.
The whole thing.
I think you're right, Avner, and we have to hope for that. I want to thank you so much for this interview. It's been very revealing and very honest. Thank you for your honesty and your extraordinary scholarship over the years about this issue, Avner Cohen.
It has been a pleasure.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
On If You Love This Planet today, I've been speaking with Dr. Avner Cohen, an internationally recognized author and expert on non-proliferation issues with the James Martin Center for Non-Proliferation Studies in Washington, D.C. His latest book, The Worst Kept Secret, Israel's Bargain with the Bomb, has just been published in October 2010 by Columbia University Press. If you want to check up on other interviews in this program, go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org. If you would like to contribute indeed to this effort, there's a page where you can contribute. We'd be very grateful. And tune in next week for another really fascinating interview, although I say it myself and shouldn't, as my mother used to say. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.